So, Jeremy, welcome, welcome. Do just tell us as we start off, those wigs that judges wear, what exactly is the point?
Well, of course, it's historic. Lawyers are conservative by nature, and this goes back to the time when everybody wore wigs. So we're talking about 18th century. Yes. Everybody wore wigs, and judges simply continued to wear them when everybody else stopped. But in fact, there is a point, because I've just been talking to people over here during coffee. They didn't know I was the speaker. It's really quite a good disguise, isn't it? The wig, in fact, I've been in cases and I've been able to walk out of court without my wig and so on, and the jury don't know it's me. It's very interesting that. So there's a degree of anonymization, and in a criminal trial that's probably a very good thing, because not only is there a question of safety for the judge, self-evidently, though that's not normally an issue, but in fact the whole process works on the basis that it's not simply an individual there, it's someone who's carrying out a function. So it's helpful to have that degree of anonymity. You're doing a job in administering justice on behalf of the state. So perhaps there's a plus, that they're uncomfortable.
Particularly in hot weather.
Particularly in hot weather.
Now, just give us an idea of the kind of cases that you would be trying as a High Court judge. So this isn't like small claims court stuff, is it? Just give it the scale of the cases.
Well, there are two types of cases that I'll do, and you may want to talk about both. In fact, I was basically a commercial judge, which means that I didn't usually wear the Father Christmas outfit, as I call it, the big red robes with ermine and the wig and so on and so forth. When you sit in a commercial court, you sit in a suit, because it's a business court, and we like to think we're up to date and we know what's going on and so on and so forth. And in that context, I'd be handling the sort of things that arise out of business in the city, in Canary Wharf, trading contracts one kind or another, shipping, insurance, a lot of banking, a lot of derivative arguments, that sort of thing, investment, all the big transactions that go on and which, when they go wrong, give rise to disputes. So they then come to the commercial court in London and the commercial court tries to sort it out.
Do you want to just give us an example of what was the biggest case you tried in the commercial court?
Well, the biggest one involved... do I mention names? It's all right.
Names is fine here. Yeah.
It's public, yes. Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank had a big foreign exchange deal, in fact a sequence of deals, and the trial in question lasted for about 4 months. They were being counterclaimed against for $8 billion, so it's quite a big claim. 4 months worth of hearings. I can't remember how many witnesses, but certainly about 12 or 14 experts, and probably the better part in terms of witnesses, documents that were so large they couldn't all be got into the courtroom, so we did it all on computer, it was all computerised, and quite hard work, really.
Yes,
an 800-page judgment I wrote at the end of it.
Wow.
So, okay. Yeah, it took me a month to write.
Yeah. So you have to like reading in your job as well. Reading and writing.
There's a lot of reading, there's a lot of writing, a lot of analysis. It's quite challenging intellectually, the commercial side. Yeah.
Yes. What exactly is the role of the judge then? Because most of us have seen courtrooms from the other side, we've been in the dock and so on. So the judge that sits up there, what exactly are you supposed to do?
Well, in a commercial case, in a civil case, the judge makes the decision. And it's as simple as that. And the parties have to try and persuade the judge that they're right. So it's all down to you. You run the trial, you make sure that the whole thing is done fairly, you make sure that the evidence which is adduced is admissible, and if it isn't, then you simply ignored it anyway. And you make the decision, yeah. Who's right, who's wrong, who wins, who gets the money, who... whatever.
Yes. And you've been involved in some pretty high-profile cases as well that have hit the media, so... including a cricketing one. You want to tell us about that?
Well, most people, of course, when they think of law, probably not you, because you're an educated audience who understand the city, but most people, when they think of law, think of crime, don't they? And that's where people wear the wigs and all the flummery goes on. Though it has a point, as I say. And so most of the cases that I talk about tend to be the criminal cases that I did, because those are the ones that people understand much more readily and tend to find rather more interesting. And for those of you who are cricket fans, I tried the Pakistani cricketers who were found guilty of spot fixing a few years ago. I was running the South East Circuit at the time, so I had to decide which judges were going to do which cases. And I thought, if anybody's going to be paid to watch cricket, it'll be me. And it's the only case that I actually specifically chose to do myself. In fact, it turned out not to be very exciting at all. I don't know if any of you remember this. This is the one where they bowled no balls. And the lad is now back playing, having been banned for 5 years. He wasn't really very experienced at doing this in a way that wasn't obvious. And when he came into bowl and you saw the film, he was about a yard over the line with his back foot, so that it was blindingly obvious. And we had to cut out the commentary from the commentators on television, because Ian Botham, Sir Ian Botham, biggest bomb, was heard to say, "My, that was a big one." He was about that much over the line. Yeah, so that was interesting. I felt sorry for the lad, and Mohammed Amir, who's back playing. He was an 18-year-old at the time. He was led astray by the skipper and other people who'd been doing this sort of thing for years.
Yeah. Now, English cricket supporters were pretty happy with the result of that, but some of the locals in Pakistan were not best pleased at your judgment.
No. My main claim to fame in life, I think, is that I've been burnt in effigy twice. And the first time was in Karachi, following this case. The population there wasn't best pleased. I always thought if I went to India, I might be much more popular.
Now, tell us about the second time, because that was a bit closer to home.
Second time. Down in Sussex, I was sitting in a criminal trial in Sussex involving some manufacturers of fireworks. It's a sad story, because these manufacturers of fireworks, they had, in fact, some illegal explosives. You may or may not know that explosives and fireworks are classified into various classes. And there's one class which is a military class, which basically you shouldn't have. And they had some of these. And something went wrong, and when they were trying to sort out some fireworks, a bit damp after a display that had been cooled off. And a fire began in the fireworks factory. And it was in a container that was full of these fireworks that they brought back. And along came the fire brigade to sort it out. And the fire brigade aren't told that amongst these fireworks are these literally military-type explosives. And rather cheekily, the prosecution rather cheaply, I thought, brought one into court. And it was this size, and it looked just like a cartoon bomb. All it needed was "bomb" written on the front for people to see it, but an enormous great thing. And some of these caught and went off, and there was an explosion, and two firemen were literally blown to pieces, not having been told that there was explosives of that kind. So the men responsible for the firework manufacturers were prosecuted for manslaughter by gross negligence, and duly went down. What I didn't know was that they were actually responsible for one of the bonfire societies in Lewes. And in Lewes in Sussex, they celebrate November the 5th with great gusto. And the bonfire societies each year try and outdo each other. There are 9 of them, I think. And they each make a float with a hate figure on it, who can then be burnt in effigy. So yours truly was burnt in effigy once again. But as long as it's only an effigy, I'm not too troubled.
Well, feel lots of love coming from us today. Tell us a bit about how you came to faith in Christ yourself.
Well, I was very fortunate, really, because I was brought up in a Christian home, Christian parents, and I was taken to church and to Bible classes, and brought up to know what it meant to be a Christian. But, of course, there comes a point where you have to decide for yourself. And that really happened to me, I suppose, between the ages of 14 and 16. And I think there were two things, really, that struck me at the time. And the first was simply this. If it's true, if Christianity is true, then nothing else matters. That's got to be the key to life. I was going through, I suppose, typical teenage angst at the time. You know, what is life about? What am I about? What's it? And everything seemed infinite, depressing, and so on and so forth. And so that was the first thing. If it's true. And I knew it was true. I looked at it in some detail, even at that age, and I could see, yes, there is truth. This is the only coherent explanation for the world as we know it, and for all that goes on. And the second and very persuasive thing was this. I simply saw people who were already Christians, who were a little bit older. They were sort of undergraduates, that sort of age. And I could see what it meant to them and how it changed their lives. And putting those two things together, I saw already, I've got no option here. It's true, I've got to live by it. I need Christ to be my Lord. And so I couldn't name a time, but certainly over a period, I guess, of a year, year and a half, something like that.
Yes,
I would have come to a point saying, "I'm committed. This is the way I've got to go."
So it made sense of the world. You saw it in other people, transformed lives. Also, the resurrection was quite a key thing.
Resurrection is the key thing, isn't it? I think when you come to look at, is it true? Because if you can only explain the fact of the empty tomb by the resurrection of Jesus, and I think that is the only coherent and sensible and logical explanation. Then where else do you go? Someone who rises from the dead, someone who says he's going to rise from the dead, someone who's taught the way Jesus taught. What else can you do? You explain. You have to say at the end of the day, he is who he said he is. He is God. This is God himself come to do something for us. And so being convinced about the resurrection was a key in that first stage, so to speak.
You've got a bit of a reputation for eating daffodils in public. What's going on there? It's connected with the resurrection, I believe.
Yes. You probably see it on YouTube. Yes, it's something that I saw die, actually, years and years ago when I was a lad. But the story goes like this, really. You say to people, you take a daffodil and you simply start eating it. And I advise you only to eat the yellow bit at the top. Don't eat the stalk because you will likely finish up in hospital. But if you eat the top of the daffodil, it's actually pretty tasteless and it just crumbles in your mouth. It was a talk I used to give to kids, and I used to say to kids, now, if you go home and you tell your dad, the man up the front ate a daffodil at church, he said, don't be silly. People don't do that sort of thing. And then if you and your brother and your sister went home and said the same thing, you all said the same thing, you might begin to wonder. And then if some lads from next door and a few parents who'd been in the church came in and said the same thing, you think, well, it might just be true. And then if 500 people came in and said, he'd eaten a daffodil, you'd probably believe it. And that's all that witness is doing, is saying what they saw or heard. And when you come to look at the stories of the resurrection of Jesus, we do indeed find that 500 people saw Jesus alive at one time. There are a whole list of people that Paul records in his letter to the Corinthians. There's the evidence. So that was the point of it.
Yes. So you, as a high court judge, you look at the evidence of the Christian faith, you find it very compelling and persuasive. Why do you think more people aren't convinced by it?
Well, I think knowing truth is not enough, is it? Because if you're going to be a Christian, it means a complete change in life. And people find that hard. People don't want to believe. So I know of people who've been convinced of the truth and yet have not become Christians because they felt it would cost too much. I can think of two people, one of whom I used to play rugby with this years ago at university. And he used to come with me to various meetings. It was quite plain he'd become completely convinced that this was the truth. And then I could see him in his mind saying, no, I do not want to go that way. It means I'm going to have to give up all sorts of things. No longer is my life going to be mine. It's going to be Christ's. And I don't want that. And he went off in a different way, and he's become really rather a hardened character. He's a very amiable chap on the face of it. I still see him from time to time. He's a doctor. But I could see him saying that. There's someone right at an early stage of life, been about 19, 20, 21 at the time, I guess. And then another man who I was talking to not all that long ago, and he's at the other end of life. He's a bit older than I am, in his 70s. And he said to me, you know, I think it's all true. I think it's all true. But I can't make that commitment. I'm afraid to commit myself. After a lifetime of living for himself, the idea that he would then simply commit himself to living for Christ was too much. was fear in there, I think, all sorts of things in there. Keep praying for it. Mm.
How do you stop yourself from becoming judgmental? So if you've spent your working life on the bench and your people in the dock and so on, how have you prevented yourself from feeling superior morally to people?
Well, there's a well-known disease which is called judgeitis, which is all about people who think they're very important and they get very pompous and very arrogant and they are indeed judgmental. But the bottom line, I guess, from a Christian perspective, is we're all in the same boat together. We're all sinners. And we all done things that are wrong, and we all don't put God in the centre. And the people who are doing crime are doing things that society regards as rather more serious than the sort of things that you and I do. But when I impose a sentence, or when I was giving judgment, I wouldn't see myself as being in any way superior. I'm simply God's agent to do, to get things right, to put things right. Because justice is, in the end, about putting things right. Justice is not about punishment as such. It's about putting right. The Hebrew word for it specifically has that connotation. And so that's what I would be trying to do with God's help. There's a verse that came home to me just before I was appointed a judge, which says in terms when talking about judges, you do not judge for man, you judge for the Lord. And that's what I've always tried to do.
Didn't you have an interesting chat with the Queen once about this kind of issue?
A great name-dropping thing. I bung this in whenever I can. I said, when I was talking to the Queen. Of course, I've only ever had one conversation with the Queen. But on that occasion, she asked me this question. She said, are criminals different from other people? Very interesting, see? And I was actually able to talk to her about the disposition of people to do wrong, what we call original sin, the tendency to do wrong, but also the propensity to do right. And we chatted about that for some time, but what I was saying to her was essentially what I've just said to you. It's only a question of fact and degree. We're all in the same boat with temptations to do wrong, and we give way to some, and criminals give way to others, and many people do offending that's serious in the eyes of society come from much harder situations than you and I do, and face much bigger temptations to do those things than you or I face, and they give way. They're responsible for it, of course they are, as we're all responsible for our decisions, but at the end of the day, people are people, and the Bible says simply, doesn't it, all have gone wrong, all have sinned and fall short of God's glory, none of us meet his standards.
Judges, as we said at the beginning, are often not popular for the decisions they take. And likewise with God, I guess people nowadays, God is a judge, they don't like that idea. Or what do you sort of make of that yourself, that the idea that God is a judge and will punish and so on?
Well, I regard it as extremely comforting. The idea that at the end of the day justice is going to be done is, I think, enormously comforting. And the idea that life is going to go on, unfairness will continue, there'll be injustice, people treated wrongly, badly, and so on and so forth. That's a terrible thing. But the idea that God's going to put it right at the end of the day, I think, is exhilarating. It's, as I say, it's unpopular if you're on the wrong side of it, and that's the key, isn't it? When God comes to call us to account, what are we going to say to him? Here's the essence of the Christian message, isn't it? That it's not what I've done, because God looks on me as he looks on Christ, if I'm a Christian, because I'm in Christ, and he forgives, and he looks on Christ and attributes Christ's righteousness to me. Now, that's fantastic, isn't it?
So the idea.
Otherwise, I'd be really worried about facing God.
Yes, I was going to ask, so if, you know, one day you're going to be on the other side of the bench and in the dock, but you feel confident as you look forward to that day?
What do sportsmen say? Quietly confident? Yeah. Yes, confident not in me, but in Jesus. And that's the key again, isn't it? That Jesus' death and resurrection are so central that you can stake your life on it.
Yes.
And it's good for eternity.
Yeah. Maybe a final question. So punishment is obviously part of the justice system. With all those that you've sort of sent down over the years and so on, have there been any sort of happy endings in terms of redemption from these terrible situations and things coming good for someone?
There have. I wouldn't say a huge number, at least not a huge number I know of, but I certainly know of one lad for whom that was the case. It's probably too long a story to tell, but the bottom line was he'd been involved in a kidnapping, and he turned up to give evidence as a defendant from the dock, and he gets into the dock, and he says, "I've sworn an oath to tell the truth on the New Testament, and I'm going to do it." And he probably spills the beans on what he'd been up to and what everybody else had been up to. And it was quite plain that he had, during his time waiting for trial, been thinking about the Bible. And I was able then to put him in touch with a group that goes into to prisons, a Christian group. And the man has come to faith, or come back to faith, possibly, because he had been brought up in a Christian home. So there is an example. Can I make a plug here?
Yes.
You don't know about this. I have a radio program once a week on Premier Radio. It's called In the Dock. But this coming Thursday, in fact, it's recorded on Thursday, but I think you'll hear it on the Saturday, or better still, podcast, because you've probably got better things to do at 2 o'clock on Saturday. There's a man called Teddy Ellis who became a Christian whilst in prison, and he's coming on the program to talk about that.
Fantastic.
So, podcast, In the Dock.
Brilliant. Jeremy's now going to speak to us, so we're going to have a couple of readings. Paul's going to come and read those to us, and then Jeremy will speak after that.
The first reading is taken from Luke chapter 1, verses 1 to 4, and then we'll skip ahead to Luke chapter 8, starting at verse 49. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. While he was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house came and said, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher any more." But Jesus, on hearing this, answered him, "Do not fear, only believe, and she will be well." And when he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him, except Peter and John and James, and the father and mother of the child. And all were weeping and mourning for her. But he said, "Do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But taking her by the hand, he called, saying, "Child, arise," and her spirit returned, and she got up at once. And he directed that something should be given her to eat, and her parents were amazed. But he charged them not to tell anyone what had happened.
I've got to say two more things that Marcus didn't ask me. The first is that no judge in England has a gavel. It's true. All the American judges have it. No judge in England does. So, second question to the kids was wrong. Last question to the kids was wrong. There we are. Never mind. Not for this country, anyway. The second question is, when you have your photo taken as when you're appointed a judge, you are told specifically not to smile. And the reason is this, because they say, that's the photo that will appear in the newspaper. And the only time your photo will appear in the newspaper is either after you've just sent someone to prison for 40 years, in which case you shouldn't be smiling, or you've been caught in some terrible scandal. And again, that's not a good idea. Let's just pray together, shall we? Lord, please direct our thinking and help us to see more of Jesus. In his name. Amen. A famous but corrupt judge once asked, "What is truth?" Jesting Pilate, as Huxley refers to him. "What is truth?" said Jesting Pilate, and would not stay for an answer. And there was a judge accused with a man in front of him who was accused of treason. He said he was a king, but not from this world, from another place. What's more, that man said that he came to give evidence about the truth. Jesus claimed to give evidence of ultimate truth with the authority from another place, the authority of the ruler of all creation.
And Pilate's stance was that of the cynic, namely that truth couldn't be ascertained, or was not readily ascertained, or that it wasn't important compared with the reality of politics, realpolitik. But the whole process of law is based on the premise that truth is discoverable from what we call evidence, which, as Pilate readily recognised in relation to the man in front of him, should have led to an acquittal. But he ignored the evidence in bringing in a conviction for his own personal reasons, seeking to deny his responsibility with the hand-washing and so on. A fixed trial, a corrupt verdict, and he was responsible. He knew that evidence was important. He knew that the truth was in fact discoverable. He knew that the prisoner was innocent, but wouldn't take the obvious and logical conclusion from it. And as that shows, judges can get things wrong. In the commercial court where I used to sit, we have a number of advocates who practiced as lawyers elsewhere in the world before they came to become advocates and train again and re-qualify in England. And on one occasion I had such an advocate in front of me who'd been trained in New York. And he was much more used to the way in which these American courts operate. And so he didn't have that elegant, smooth, measured, understated style of the classic English barrister. At all events, it was a commercial case, and I came to make an extemporary judgment, which was adverse to his clients. Naturally, in my customary way, it was fluently articulated, it was logically impeccable, and as far as I could see, would take the matter beyond any argument from any reasonable perspective. But I could see that he wasn't very impressed. In fact, he looked distinctly aggrieved. As I concluded, he stood up. He looked at me and he said, "Well," I won't do the American accent. "What would happen," he said, "if I said that you were a demented, degenerate, stupid old fool?" Well, I've no sense of self-importance, as you've doubtless gathered, but I thought nonetheless it was wise to tell him of the potential consequences. "Very simple," I said. "I could report you to the Bar Standards Board. You could be subject to disciplinary proceedings. You could be fined. You could be suspended. Or you could be struck off. Alternatively, I could simply imprison you for contempt of court." That gave him pause, but only for a moment. He looked me balefully in the eye and he said, "And what if I just thought it?" I said, "There's nothing whatever I can do about that. Free country, you can think whatever you like." Then he said, "Let the record show that I think you are a demented, degenerate, stupid old fool." Do you know the word "the record"? The record. The record is what records the evidence and submissions of counsel. What is evidence? Well, as we've already discussed in my discussions with Marcus, evidence of fact in its simplest form is simply someone saying what they've seen, heard, or perhaps experienced. You may have been hit on the back of the head by someone mugging you, and you may not have seen or heard much, but you've certainly experienced something, and you can give evidence of it. Leave opinion evidence of scientific matters and the like out of account for the moment, expert evidence, but so far as evidence of fact is concerned, it's simply a person describing what he or she personally witnessed. And that person may be truthful and accurate, or they may be lying, or they may be honest but inaccurate for any number of reasons. And that has to be assessed by reference to all the surrounding circumstances. The motivation for telling the truth or a lie, or for the reason for not being accurate, such as they were drunk, or they were looking in the wrong direction at the time, or not paying attention, or whatever it might be. Direct evidence of that kind is to be distinguished from what you've doubtless heard of as hearsay evidence. Hearsay evidence is simply what someone says someone else told them happened, or alternatively is in writing what someone has written down as to what happened. That evidence is just as much evidence as direct evidence, but has to be looked at a little bit more carefully because of the transmission, to see whether there's reasons not to trust either the person who said it in the first place or the person who is now repeating it. But the court's task is to look at all the evidence in the round and come to a conclusion as to what it shows. Weigh it up and decide what happened. What is evidence? Well, what's history? That's the title of a book I read some 52 years ago, I think it was, when I was trying to get into Oxford to read law. I had to do papers in history in order to read law. But simply put, history is an attempt to research the evidence, the records, to see what people said and heard and did and reach a conclusion as to what it truly shows, to decide what really happened. So what a historian does is pretty much like what a court does in reality. And at the end of the day, it's no good a judge or a jury or an historian saying, I don't know, I can't decide. You've got to look at it, all the evidence in the round, and say, now, what is the most coherent explanation? What fits the facts that those things, those bits of evidence that we accept as reliable? What is the truth? What really happened? Now, when Luke wrote his narrative, he was involved in just such a task. You've got the passage in front of you on your service sheet there. And he tells us, in those opening verses, that many people had drawn up an account of what had taken place on the basis of what they and he were told by those who'd witnessed the events in question. Do you see that? Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us. So he's been talking to the very people who saw the events in question. And he decided to write an orderly account, having investigated the matter carefully. It seemed good to me, having followed all things closely, having investigated them, as some other translations have it, to write an orderly account for you. Why? So that you may be certain, so that you may have certainty. And so we can be confident that what Luke was doing was going to the horse's mouth, finding out from those who'd been with Jesus what had happened. And that's why I think when one looks at the Gospel of Luke as compared with the other Gospels, you'll see that some things they record are the same events and some of the things they record are different events. Because Matthew and John, of course, were there. They record what they saw, what they heard. And in Luke's case, he wasn't. So he's gone to eyewitnesses who were. And Mark is thought to have got his information from Peter. But the point is, here is the record of the evidence of what people said they saw. And Luke's second book, you may recall that Acts is a follow-on volume from Luke, the book of Acts. He describes at the beginning of Acts that what his first book's about. He said, my first book set out what Jesus began to do and teach until the day he departed from heaven, after showing himself to be alive with convincing proofs. And so what Luke is about is setting out evidence that he thinks is compelling, that is convincing proof. He intends readers to come away convinced about Jesus, about his teaching, about his life, about his death, about his resurrection, about his ascension. And so he presents the evidence. And the three key issues to which it goes, which Luke invites us to consider on the basis of the evidence, are essentially these, aren't they? Who was Jesus? What did he do? And why? And why does it matter? And those are the things to bear in mind when one looks at the evidence. He thinks it's so compelling, so convincing, that his readers can be certain. This man, Theophilus. So that you may have certainty, he says in verse 4. In the criminal courts and the civil courts of this country, we have a different standard of proof. So that in the civil courts, I have to decide whether something is more probable or not. The balance of probabilities, reduced to its essential, 51% more likely to occur than not. But the criminal courts, because the matter is considered more serious, where people's liberty is at stake, the jury had to be sure. Beyond reasonable doubt, it used to be said. That was the expression that was used. You often say to jurors, certain that you are sure of the prisoner's guilt. Certainty. That's what Luke is looking for. So there's no need here for a suspension of disbelief about events in Palestine 2,000 years ago, because people who lived there weren't gullible simpletons any more than you or I would readily accept that a man could, with just a word, heal people of disease, or raise people from dead, cure them of madness, calm storms, whatever it may be. The stories that Luke records in his gospel. Take that story of Jairus' daughter that we read in Luke chapter 8. The name Jairus doesn't appear, but that's the man who's described in the earlier verses. She's dead, the daughter. And what does Jesus say? She's not dead, but sleeping. And that's greeted with derisory laughter. They know she's dead. They've seen she's dead. They're not the sort of people who are simply going to accept a miracle without evidence. But of course, to Jesus, death is just sleep. He can wake people from death, and does so. And it's because events like that were so extraordinary that Luke invites the conclusion that Jesus is who he says he is, based on the evidence of those who are there. And remember, Luke was a doctor. Just think about it for a moment. We have a man here, Jesus, whose ethical teaching is considered the highest morality of any. He values truth and he decries falsehood. And he claims to have supernatural origins and power to do the things that he does. That has to be taken seriously and examined carefully to see if there's something in it. And then he predicts he's going to rise from the dead. And his followers, who likewise hold to truth as an intrinsic value and virtue, they value truth as much as he did, they say it happened. That evidence has to be fully examined. People then, just as people now, do not think that dead men ordinarily leave their tombs and talk and walk, invite other people to touch them, eat food, drink, prepare barbecues on the beach with their friends. It just isn't within the ordinary experience. Luke knows it's extraordinary, and he gives you the evidence. And one of the most interesting facets, I think, of not just Luke's gospel, in fact, but other gospels, is this, that there doesn't really seem to be any challenge to the historicity or validity of the healings and miracles that are witnessed. The issue was not did they happen, but how do you account for them? Is this God at work? Who is Jesus? And in the story just before we get to Jairus' daughter, where Jesus calms the storm, the question the disciples all ask at the end after he's calmed the storm is simply this: who is this who gives orders to the wind and waves? Who is he? Examine the evidence. And the critical point in relation to his resurrection, because although Jesus predicted it, Luke tells us that when it was first reported by a group of women that the tomb was empty, the band of men with Jesus wouldn't accept that the resurrection had happened. It was only when Peter reported it, having met Jesus, and when they encountered Jesus for themselves, and he explained its significance, that they accepted it had happened. They wanted the evidence with their own eyes, or the evidence from someone they implicitly trusted, such as Peter. Well, how do we examine this evidence? How do we assess the evidence which appears in the Gospels? You can take it, if you like, simply as the records of Jesus' friends, what they said happened when they came to believe in him. The question is, how do you account for Jesus and what he said indeed? How do you account for his character alongside his claims? How do you account for the witnesses, their character, their evidence? Truth was important to them. They weren't disposed to believe in the resurrection, but they came to accept it, and then to speak of it, and speak of its significance in such a way that they were prepared to die because they thought it was so overwhelmingly important. I spoke with a neighbour at an event of something like this kind. I think it was probably a Christianity Explored event, actually, at another church. And we were in discussion in a group. And so he said he was having real trouble with the idea that Jesus was God. So I asked him, I said, well, how do you account for him? Who do you think he was? Good question, he said, but had no answer. That is the classic question. It is the critical question. And what is your answer? When I used to direct juries, you may or may not know that before the jury go out to make their decision, the judge spends quite a long time summarising all the evidence for them and telling them the questions they need to ask themselves, often giving them a route map. The question one, if you answer yes, then go to question two. If you answer no, go to question three, and so on. You give them a whole bunch of questions because they have to decide what evidence they accept. And you take them through the questions they have to ask themselves logically to arrive at the conclusion either of guilt or innocence. But when I used to direct juries about what they had to do, I'd say to them, they would never know every single fact that there was to know about what had happened. There might be some questions that they would want to ask, but would know the evidence wasn't there to answer. But what they needed to do was to evaluate the evidence they had on the critical question of guilt or innocence. And I tell them this: you are, members of the jury, entitled to draw inferences. That is, to come to common sense conclusions based on the evidence that you accept as reliable and accurate. Ignore your preconceptions. Ignore the extraneous things you may have read about the case elsewhere in the newspaper. Focus on the evidence that you've heard and decide the case on the evidence. In the end, what matters is not what I say or what the lawyers say. What matters is the evidence. The examiner. There's one other factor here, I think it's this. What's often said about good evidence is that it has the ring of truth. It is self-authenticating. You can sense its validity and its truthfulness regardless of the unusual nature of it. Because that's the thing that most people will hold against Christianity. They say it's so out of ordinary experience that we can't accept it. But people often say this, don't they? Truth is stranger than fiction. And people often say about, so no one could have made that story up. Truth sometimes does have this ring of truth. You can tell when you see it. And what Jesus actually said to his friends was that his spirit would bring to mind what he told them after he'd left them, and that his words were the words of life. So when you read the record in Luke or other Gospels, it's not just the record of an individual, but it has the self-authenticating authority of words from God. Encounter Jesus in his words. Try it and see. God speaks. Examine the evidence. At the very end of Luke, and Marcus touched on this earlier today, but at the end of Luke's account in his first book, he records an incident in which Jesus, following his resurrection, met and walked with two people who'd heard about the empty tomb but didn't know what to make of it. They'd been followers of Jesus, but they didn't immediately recognise him. The eyewitnesses' account reveal there was something slightly different about Jesus after death and resurrection. A likely feature, I guess, that we will share after our death and resurrection. His body showed the marks of crucifixion. He was physical enough to eat and drink. But in some ways, he was super physical, wasn't he? He walked through walls, came through walls and doors. Not surprising. Something different after death and resurrection. These two explained their problems to him. I'll just read to you from the very end of Luke, where they explain their difficulty. The chief priests and our rulers handed him, that's Jesus, over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. We'd hoped he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. What's more, it's the third day since this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us they'd seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they didn't see. What was Jesus' response? His response was to take them to all their Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament as we see it today, and to explain to them that what had actually happened, his death and resurrection, were the very things that had to happen to fulfill what the Jewish scriptures had said, if God's purposes were to be carried out. As Luke had said back in chapter 1, verse 1, the passage we have for us, the bulletin, fulfilled, the things that have been accomplished amongst us, the things that have been fulfilled. And they then see who Jesus is when they take the time to listen to him, what he says, when they look at their own scriptures, and when in fact he offers them food, he breaks bread and offers it to them, and they know it's him. They have the evidence then of their own experience. And that's what millions of Christians have found. Time spent with Jesus and his words, with God's word, looking to what he gives, provides the evidence in itself, in our own experience. And so let me conclude this way. If you are not yet convinced, that's where you need to go. Get a gospel. There are a number over there. This one's Luke. I think Matthew, Mark and John are both there. Get hold of the gospel and read it. Read the evidence for yourself. Read it alone if you like. Or better still, perhaps come to the Christianity Explored course, which I think is due to begin here this coming week. Or get hold of a Christian friend who's been there before and read a gospel with them. There's a lovely booklet over there called One to One. Great way of doing this together. gain from other people's experience. And if you are convinced, then this is where you need to point your friends who are not. But whatever you do, however you do it, examine the evidence. Let the evidence speak for itself. Let God speak.